Chapter 15, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. Powerful and enigmatic, intelligent and creative, idealistic on the one hand and materialistic on the other, the Jewish people have always fascinated me. Few teenagers growing up in the middle 1960s, as I did, could have avoided acquiring a positive image of Israel and the Jewish people. Because of my years of Sunday school, my perception of the Jews was even more idealized than most. I was 11 years old when I saw the classic movie Exodus. It made such an enduring impression on me that for a few months its beautiful theme song became my favorite, one that I often hum or sing. I remember an episode of embarrassment when my sister and her teenage friends stumbled upon me loudly singing the stirring words, "This land is mine. God gave this land to me." Historic Israel inspired me. It was as if the Israelites of the Bible had transported themselves to modern times to live out their Old Testament adventures once again. The televised image of Israel strongly reinforced my acceptance of the idea that Gentile intolerance had caused every historical conflict with the Jewish people. After I discovered the extensive Jewish leadership of early communism, which I had hoped was an uncharacteristic blight on Jewish history, I began to ask questions one dared not ask in polite society about this interesting people and religion. I had read about the many persecutions of the Jews throughout history, including their great suffering, now called the Holocaust. In the mid-1960s, that term had not yet been appropriated by the Jews to apply exclusively to their sufferings during the Second World War. Holocaust merely means, as it always has, large-scale destruction, especially by fire. Mark Twain wrote, "Every nation hates each other, but they all hate the Jew." Somehow, I found the impertinence to ask why. In an historical context, almost every major nation of Europe has expelled them in the past, some repeatedly, after renewed waves of Jewish immigration. What was it, I wondered, about the Jewish people that inspired such hatred? Normally, when we study historical conflicts between nations or peoples, we do it dispassionately. For instance, in examining any war from long ago, we list as objectively as possible the grievances and rationales of the opposing sides. When studying the war for Southern independence, every American schoolchild learns the Southern arguments for secession and the Northern arguments for forced union. In contrast, when studying the many historical disputes between the Jewish people and others, only the Jewish point of view is acceptable. In early 1995, Congressman Newt Gingrich, Speaker of the House, fired his newly appointed congressional librarian, Christina Jeffrey. He fired her for having once suggested that history students, when studying the Holocaust, should also study the German point of view on the subject. She was fired in spite of her high standing in her profession and notwithstanding her long and cozy relations with powerful Jewish ADL, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. The very suggestion that there could be another side to any issue affecting Jews is decried as anti-Semitic. In both the entertainment and news media, the only permissible opinion is that Jews are always innocent victims persecuted by intolerant Christians and other, quote, anti-Semites, unquote. Maybe they were always innocent, and all the other peoples of the world were always unjust, I thought. But they weren't so innocent in the Russian Revolution. I realized I could not evaluate the issue fairly until I had read both sides. One of the first things I discovered was that while Gentiles who called the Jews a, quote, race are condemned, Jewish leaders have for centuries routinely called their people a race. The foremost leader of American Jewry in the 1930s, Rabbi Stephen F. Wise, said it succinctly in his dramatic statement, quote, "Hitler was right in one thing, he calls the Jewish people a race, and we are a race." Right up to the present day, there are many statements illustrating how Jewish leaders matter-of-factly view themselves not just as a religion, but as an identifiable race, genetically distinguishable from other peoples. Noam Goldman, one of the leading Jews of the 20th century and former president of the World Jewish Organization, said it very bluntly.
Quote, Jews are divided into two categories, those who admit they belong to a race distinguished by a history thousands of years old and those who don't. The latter are open to the charge of dishonesty. Unquote. The former Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, speaking to a Jewish group in Southern California, said, quote, if Israel had not come into existence after the World War II, then I am certain the Jewish race wouldn't have survived. I stand before you and say you must strengthen your commitment to Israel. An editorial entitled, quote, Some Other Race in the New York Weekly Forward, a very prestigious Jewish publication, urges Jews to list themselves on U.S. government census forms as a race. It goes on to suggest, quote, on the question 8 of the form, which asks about race, you might consider doing what more than one member of our Radetzka editorial staff has done, checking the box Some Other Race and writing the word Jew. Charles Bronfman, a main sponsor of the 210 million Birthright Israel organization, specifically an organization committed to preserving Jewish bloodlines, Jewish genetic heritage, and preventing intermarriage between Jews and Gentiles, express the need to preserve the Jewish genetic character as expressed in the Jewish DNA. Now, Bronfman is a brother of Edgar Bronfman, Sr., president of the World Jewish Congress. And this is what he said, quote, you're losing a lot, losing the kind of feeling you have when you know that throughout the world there are people who somehow or other have the same kind of DNA that you have. He's talking about Jews who intermarry. Now imagine for a moment if President George Bush would speak to a group of white college students and tell them how great it is for them to know that others in the world share their white DNA and that they would lose it by intermarrying with other races. Now Bush could live 100 years and still never live down a remark like that. During his campaign for president in 2000, Bush spoke before dozens of Jewish organizations and synagogues that oppose intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews. The media had only praise for those appearances. In contrast, Bush faced universal criticism by the Jewish media by simply speaking at a conservative Christian university, Bob Jones University, that quietly opposes racial intermarriage. After the media unleashed a storm of criticism, Bush had to quickly apologize and then passionately condemned Bob Jones University for its position. Of course, within a few days, Bush was again speaking before many Jewish groups that stridently oppose intermarriage of Jews and non-Jews. Yet no one in the media dared object to these appearances, or even bothered to point out this blatant double standard. Looking for answers to the Jewish view on race, I returned to where I'd first learned my respect for the Jews in the Holy Bible. I went back and reread the Old Testament, paying close attention to the relationships between Jews and non-Jews. In contrast to the universalism of the New Testament, the Old Testament's extremely ethnocentric. It repeatedly identifies the Israelites as a, quote, special people or a chosen people, and it painstakingly traces the genealogical descent of the children of Israel. Many thought-provoking passages forbid the intermarriage of Jews and other tribes. In the book of Exodus, Moses responds to Israelites who had sexual relations with Moabite women by ordering that the Moabites be executed. In Ezra, God commanded those who married non-Israelites to cast off their wives and even the children of such unions. And some of the bloodiest writings I've ever read detail the Jewish people's annihilation of their tribal enemies. The massacres of Canaanites, Jacobites, Philistines, Egyptians, and dozens of other peoples are gruesomely recorded in the Bible. In today's terminology, we describe the slaughter of entire peoples as genocide. Old Testament Jews spared neither men, women, children, or even the animals and pets of their enemies. The following are just a few among dozens of similar passages found in the Old Testament. From Joshua 6:21, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword. 10:32-34. Then Horam, king of Gezer, came to help Lachish, and Joshua smote him and all his people until he had left him none remaining. And they took Eglon and smote it with the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were therein. And Joshua 10:37, and they took Hebron and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof, and all the cities thereof, and the souls that were therein. He left none remaining. And Isaiah 34:2-3, for the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them, he hath delivered them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted in their blood. And Deuteronomy 20:16, but in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God gives you for your inheritance, you shall save nothing alive that breathes. Now, my friends, as a Christian, I could not explain what appeared to be celebrations of genocide. I acknowledged that God is unfathomable and unknowable. However, I could not help but have sympathy for those who were massacred, including the thousands of innocent men, women, and children. It's easy to imagine how the few who survived those bloody, merciless massacres felt about, quote, the Jews. Of course, the ancient Jews were not unique in their pursuit of ethnic cleansing. Many other early peoples had committed genocide on their enemies. With the coming of Jesus Christ and his advocacy of love and kindness as recorded in the New Testament, the Old Testament advocacy and record of genocide is little recollected by modern churches. When a modern Christian stumbles upon such passages in the Old Testament condoning genocide, he usually dismisses them as the sad happenings of a remote biblical era, one now mitigated with the new covenant of love that Christ brings to those who accept his message. The Israelite record on racial integrity and supremacy is quite clear. And let's quote, neither shalt thou make messages with them, their daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God has chosen thee a special people unto himself above all people that are on the face of the earth. Deuteronomy 7:6. Now therefore give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek the peace or their wealth forever, that ye may be strong and eat of the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. Inheritance to your children forever. That's Ezra 9:12. Members of racial groups might argue about their comparative history or abilities or spirituality, but to suggest that God favors one people over all others, even to the point of advocating and condoning genocide to make way for the chosen, certainly that must be the apex of racial supremacy. Modern Christianity deals with the ethnocentric and genocidal parts of the Old Testament by focusing on the loving aspects of the New Testament. One example is the way that Jesus Christ reversed Old Testament law, such as an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, to turn the other cheek. The Jewish religion, however, had no comparable figure in its history to moderate the extreme ethnocentrism of the Old Testament. Perhaps the Jewish teacher who offered the greatest moderation toward Gentiles was Maimonides, considered by most Jews as the foremost figure of European Judaism. Even Maimonides decreed that Jewish physicians, though, should not save the life of a Christian unless not saving him would, quote, cause the spread of hostility against the Jews, unquote. And again, for these passages, you can get all the documentation and the citations from my book, Jewish Supremacism. The early spread of Christianity by the Apostle Paul encouraged Christians to become more tolerant of different ethnic groups. Paul himself was Jewish, a Pharisee who converted to Christianity and preached much of his life to the Gentiles of diverse nationalities. The Christian faith had intolerance for other beliefs and other gods, but no bias against other tribes. Evangelists of the ancient world themselves came from assorted peoples and preached across the known world. Of course, Christians could, and often did, harbor xenophobic tendencies, but their nationalistic or ethnocentric attitudes found their origins in their own cultures, not in the teachings of the New Testament. The book of Galatians makes the point quite well that the chosen people is neither Jew nor Greek, and are now those who accept the salvation of Jesus Christ. Salvation in the ancient world became based on acceptance of faith and not simply by possession of certain blood. The Christian religion had an evolution then quite different than that of the Jewish religion. The Jewish people and their religion are and were entwined. Belief in God was necessary to preserve the tribe as much as preserving the tribe was important to safeguarding their religion. However, according to the Jewish state of Israel, race is far more important than religious belief. A prospective immigrant to Israel does not have to practice or believe in Judaism to immigrate to Israel. In fact, he can be an outspoken atheist and a communist for that matter. He must only prove Jewish descent. Protection of the ethnic identity of the Jewish people became the main reason for Judaism's existence. In the Middle East, and later throughout the world, the Jews mingled with many peoples, and yet they preserved their heritage and their essential customs. They're the only ethnic minority in Western nations that is not assimilated after thousands of years. In Babylon, they lived under slavery and then under domination for hundreds of years and developed a code that enabled them not only to survive, but to prosper while living as a minority in an alien society. When they emerged from their Babylonian sojourn, they were stronger, more organized, and more ethnocentric than ever before. In rejecting Jesus Christ and the love and tolerance he preached, Judaism proceeded on its path of chauvinism. It culminated in the pages of the Talmud, an encyclopedic exposition of Jewish law and custom compiled by hundreds of rabbis over the centuries. The American Heritage Dictionary describes it as, quote, constituting the basis of religious authority for traditional Judaism. The Talmud was first transcribed in Babylonian times, and the oral tradition is many centuries older. By the 6th century AD, it was written down, becoming the most important religious work of the Jewish people and the chief canon of their religion. In it, they finally codified their most chauvinistic tendencies. Hermann Wouk, the very famous Jewish writer, describes the influence of the Talmud as follows. The Talmud is to this day the circulating heart's blood of the Jewish religion. Whatever laws, customs, or ceremonies we observe, whether we are Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, or merely spasmodic sentimentalists, we follow the Talmud. It is our common law. As a 16-year-old, during one of my visits to the Citizens Council offices, I had found a book called The Jewish Religion, Its Influence Today. It was by Elizabeth Dilling. It interested me because the large format of the book contained complete photocopied pages from parts of the Talmud, officially compiled by Jewish scholars, an English translation of that which was published by Jewish rabbinical societies. Now, I remember skipping Dilling's commentary and going right to the translations. One of the first passages I read really surprised me. It said, quote, a heathen, Gentile, who pries into the Torah and other Jewish scriptures is condemned to death, for it's written, it is our inheritance, not theirs. Now, if a 16-year-old boy reads something forbidden like that, he is certainly bound to read on. The passage was completely alien to everything I'd always understood about religion. Why would they not want all men to read their holy words the same way Christians want to spread the good news? Just what is it in these scriptures that would oblige the Jews to kill a Gentile that read them? Why would public knowledge of Jewish scriptures be dangerous to Jews? I went to the library and found some old translations of parts of the Talmud. It was not long before I came across another, even more amazing passage, such as, quote, Balaam, Jesus, is raised from the dead and being punished in boiling hot semen. Those who mock the words of the Jewish sages and sin against Israel are boiled in hot excrement. It's from 57a Gittin. Now, when I asked my Jewish friend's rabbi about the passage, he told me that Balaam was not Jesus. Now, he sounded pretty convincing. But that very evening, I looked up Balaam in the Jewish Encyclopedia and was shocked to read that Balaam was a pseudonym for Jesus. Because Christian scholars periodically obtain copies of the Talmud, Talmudic scribes hoped to deceive them by using the name Balaam to denote Jesus. In the Jewish Cyclopedia, under the heading Balaam, it says, and I quote, "The pseudonym Balaam, given to Jesus in Sanhedrin 106b and Gittin 57a. Again, that quote, Balaam is raised from the dead and being punished in boiling hot semen. The Talmud repeatedly uses obscure words to denote Gentiles with an assortment of names such as Egyptian, heathen, Cuthian, idolater. In the most popular English language translation of the Talmud, called the Sassino edition, the practice is often illustrated by the fifth footnote of the Book of Sanhedrin. That footnote reads, quote, Cuthian, Samaritan, was here substituted for the original Goy. Yeah, that's Christians are sometimes referred to by the code word men or minim. Now, the footnotes of the Sanhedrin edition of Talmud, as well as passages in the Jewish Cyclopedia, blatantly mention this intentional artifice. The Encyclopedia Judaica also notes that, quote, in rabbinical literature, the distinction between Gentile, Goy, Akam, and Christian, Naziri, has frequently been obscured by textual alterations necessitated by the vigilance of censors. Thus, Egyptian, Amalekite, Zeruchite, Sadducee, and Kuti, Samaritan, often stands in place of the original Nazari, as well as Goy, Akam, etc. Probably when Resh Lasky stated that a Gentile, Akam, in existing texts, who observed the Sabbath, is punishable by death, Sanhedrin 58b, he had in mind Christians. Numerous anti-Christian polemic passages only make real sense after Naziri has been restored in place of the spurious Kuti or Zadokite. Now, in other passages of the Talmud, I discovered a possible reason why some of the Talmud's writers had forbidden Gentiles to read it. And I'll let you listen to these passages. And maybe you can realize, maybe you can decide for yourself why they don't want Gentiles to read this book. Only Jews are human. Gentiles are animals. That's from Baba Mazia, 114a, 114b. For murder, whether of a Cuthian Gentile by a Cuthian or of an Israelite by a Cuthian, punishment is incurred. But of a Cuthian by an Israelite, there is no death penalty. Sanhedrin 57a. Even the best of the Gentiles should be killed, Babylonian Talmud. If a Jew is tempted to do evil, he should go to a city where he's not known and do the evil there, Moed Katan 17a. Gentiles' flesh is as the flesh of asses, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. If a heathen, Gentile, hits a Jew, the Gentile must be killed. Hitting a Jew is hitting God. Now, that sounds a little bit like idolatry to me, my friends. If an ox of an Israelite gores the ox of a Canaanite, there is no liability. But if an ox of a Canaanite, Gentile, gores an ox of an Israelite, the payment must be made in full. Baba Kema, Kema 37b. If a Jew finds an object lost by a heathen, Gentile, it does not have to be returned. Baba Mezia 24a, affirmed also in Baba Kema 113b. God will not spare a Jew who marries his daughter to an old man or takes a wife for his infant son or returns a lost article to a Cuthian, a Gentile, Sanhedrin 76a. What a Jew obtains by theft from a Cuthian, Gentile, he may keep, Sanhedrin 57a. Gentiles are outside the protection of the law, and God has exposed their money to Israel, Baba Kama 37b. Jews may use lies, subterfuges, to circumvent a Gentile, Baba Kama 13, 113a. All Gentile children are animals, Yabamoth 98a. Gentiles prefer sex with cows, Abdora Zera 22a, 22b. The vessels of Gentiles, do they not impart a worsened flavor to the food cooked in them, Abdora Zera 67b. It astonished me to read such unmitigated hatred from the chief writings of the Jewish religion. It was obvious that these quotations were all authentic because the copies I had read were published by Jewish organizations I could not find any rational explanation of such writings being in the Jewish sacred books. In fact, it became clear to me that most Americans don't even know that such writings even exist. Since the publishing of my autobiography, My Awakening, the ADL and other organizations have criticized my characterization of the Talmud as anti-Gentile and that Balaam was the Jewish moniker for Jesus Christ. They refuted through typical Talmudic prevarication. They quote obscure passages and have scholars make interpretations that serve their argument, but they don't dare to quote their own major historical Jewish publications that interpret the Talmud exactly the same way that I do. The Jewish Encyclopedia, compiled by dozens of major rabbinic organizations from all over the world, says the Talmud makes clear that Balaam is Jesus and that Gentiles are not men. The anti-Gentile Talmudic quotes were at first hard for me to believe, as they will be for many readers. However, if anyone doubts their authenticity, an easy way to verify the Talmud's extreme hatred against Gentiles is by reading the Jewish Encyclopedia. In the very article, Gentiles, it makes clear the Talmud's clear hatred toward non-Jews. Under the subtitle, Discrimination Against Gentiles, on pages 617 to 621, it clearly shows the Talmud's attitude toward non-Jews. Here are some excerpts. They held that only Israelites are men. Gentiles they classed not as men, but as barbarians. Another reason for the discrimination was the vile and vicious character of the Gentiles, whose flesh is like the flesh of asses and issues like the issue of horses. And this goes on and on. The presumption is that Gentiles obtain possession by seizure. He withdrew protection of shining legal protection from Gentiles' property rights. And Gentiles' property is considered public property like the unclaimed land in the desert. Now, the 1907 edition of the Funk and Wagnalls Jewish Encyclopedia mentions a quotation of Rabbi Simon ben Yohai, a giant of Talmudic literature. And that quotation is often quoted by anti-Semites. The quotation reads, and they point that out, Tob shibi goyim harag. The best of the goyim is to be killed. Now, it says this anti-Gentile statement was a reaction of a rabbi whose life experiences may furnish an explanation for his animosity. Yet the passage continues revealingly. In the connection in which it stands, the import of this observation is similar to that of two others. The most pious woman is addicted to sorcery, and the best of snakes ought to have its head crushed. Now, the Talmudic quotations I reproduce here are by no means taken out of context. It's true that the Talmud is comprised of many writings and has many commentaries throughout. It also sometimes actually has disputes on certain issues. However, there is absolutely no mistaking the decidedly anti-Gentile tone that dominates the Talmud throughout it. The exhortation, for instance, that the best of Gentiles should be killed is located in at least three different sections. Now imagine for a moment if a prominent Christian pronounced that, quote, the best of the Jews should be killed. Would not such a statement be forcefully condemned? Imagine the media opprobrium that would be heaped upon the offending words and its author. Perversely, if one exposes the intolerance of the Talmud, the one who exposes the intolerance of the Talmud is the one likely to face accusations of religious prejudice and intolerance. When I first sought to read the Talmud, I noticed a strange thing. I had a hard time finding a copy. It is not sold in bookstores, and most libraries don't have copies. Admittedly, the Talmud is a few times the size of the Bible, but certainly, in mass quantities, the Talmud could be printed for a nominal cost, much like the Bible is, on thin paper and in inexpensively bound volumes. As the most holy writ of one of the world's major religions, there must be significant human interest in it. Why, then, must one usually go to a synagogue or pay hundreds of dollars for an original Cincino edition? Why is it so hard to get the Talmud, the complete Talmud, in English? One must ask why it is not readily available for the public to read. The answer is probably found in the fact that the Jewish organizations that oversee the distribution rights to such writings don't want them widely read. When one reads the Talmudic books, one can understand their concern. As an idealistic teenager, I was totally unprepared for this dark side of a faith that I always respected. My impression had been that the Jewish faith had no animosity toward Jesus Christ. I was always told that they had much respect for Jesus Christ as a prophet, or at least a great teacher, but simply did not accept him as the Messiah. It disturbed me to have come across violently obscene descriptions of the Savior and of Christians in the Talmud. Among other things, Christ is described as a charlatan, a seducer, an evildoer. It accuses Christ of having sexual intercourse with his donkey, and it describes the Virgin Mary as a whore. When I first read extensive sections of the Talmud, even with the Jewish published translations in front of me, I did not want to believe that they were authentic. I approached another Jewish acquaintance, Mark Cohen, and gave him a page of these quotations. He seemed equally upset by them. By the look on his face, I knew instantly that he was completely unfamiliar and unsympathetic with this Talmudic writ. He offered to ask his rabbi about their authenticity. The rabbi confirmed that the quotations were genuine, but claimed that those views were not currently held by most Jews of today. I willingly believe this, and I still believe it is true of the average Jew. At the same time, however, knowing that such passages existed helped me to understand why there has been so much anti-Jewish sentiment over the centuries. It also offered insight into the anti-Gentile animus that dominated Judaism. It should be noted that all rabbis study the Talmud. How would Jews react if Christian preachers studied Mein Kampf as part of their holy writ, but excused it by saying that the book has no effect on their current attitudes? It may sound shocking to the uninformed, but any open-minded reader who reads both Mein Kampf and the Talmud would find the Talmud to be the more wrathful and hateful of the two. For despite Hitler's vitriolic language against the Jews, few of his statements approach the hatred reflected by Talmudic quotes, such as, quote, "the best of the Gentiles should be killed." Hitler never asks or suggests the best of the Jews should be killed, and never suggests they should be killed at all in his book. In Mein Kampf, Hitler asks the question of whether or not Jews are Germans, whereas the Talmud states that Gentiles are not even human beings, but animals. I looked up anti-Semitism in the major encyclopedias. All of them attempted to explain historical anti-Semitism purely as Christian intolerance toward Jews. Sometimes they even suggested that Christians persecuted Jews simply because the Gospels blamed the Jews for the crucifixion of Christ. They never even suggested that one of the sources of anti-Semitism could have been the hateful and ethnocentric attitudes of the Jews themselves as expressed toward Gentiles in their own religious writ and laws. Even during the life of Jesus Christ, the forces of organized Jewry opposed this kind-hearted teacher who spoke of the power of love and reconciliation, rather than the militant anti-Roman measures hoped for by the Pharisees. The New Testament records faithfully the intense Jewish terror used to suppress the early Christian faith. In one of the Gospel's most chilling verses, it is written, this is from John 8:13, "Howbeit that no man spake openly of him, Christ, for fear of the Jews." From the early centuries of Christianity, some Gentile scholars became fluent in Hebrew. They developed bitterness toward Jews based on the contents of the Talmudic writings they read. Down through the intervening centuries, dozens of popes issued edicts and encyclicals condemning Judaism. They expressed outrage not because the Jews crucified Christ, but because the Talmud's vicious anti-Gentile and anti-Christian passages. Here's a short selection of some of the Pope's views about the Jews. Gregory IX condemned the Talmud as containing, quote, every kind of vileness and blasphemy against Christian doctrine, unquote. Benedict XIII, his bull on the Jews, 1450, declared, the heresies, vanities, and errors of the Talmud prevent the Jews from knowing the truth. Innocent IV burned the Talmud in 1233 as a book of evil. John XXII banned the Talmud in 1322. Julius III, papal bull Contra Hebrus Retentes Libros, 1554, ordered the Talmud burnt everywhere. Paul IV, bull cum nemus absurdum, 1555, powerfully condemned Jewish usury and anti-Christian activities. Pius IV condemned Jewish genocidal writings. Pius V expelled the Jews from all papal states. Gregory XIII said, in a papal bull of 1581, moved by an intense hatred of the members of Christ, they continued to plan horrible crimes against the Christian religion with daily increasing audacity. And Clement VIII condemned Jewish genocidal writings. Not only did the founders of the Catholic Church take this dim view of the Jews, I was amazed to find that the great reformer and founder of Protestantism, Martin Luther, shared the same passionate opposition toward them. As a teenager, I had great admiration for Martin Luther, and I was keen to find out what the founder of Protestant Christianity had to say about Jews. A mail-order catalog of books on the Jewish question at the Citizens Council office listed a translation of a book by Martin Luther with the abrasive title, The Jews and Their Lies. The great Martin Luther was a biblical scholar who read Hebrew. He had thoroughly researched the books of the Talmud in their original language, and he had reacted to them with revulsion. Going on to read compilations of Luther's sermons and writings, I was astonished at his passionate anti-Jewish tone. And I'll quote here from some of the Weimar and Erlanger editions of Luther's works. They have been taught so much deadly hatred against the Gentiles by their parents and rabbis since their earliest youth, and continue to feed their hate during all the years of their lives. And this hatred has saturated their very blood and flesh, fills the very marrow of their bones, and has become inseparable from their whole being. Another, their Talmud and their rabbis teach them that a murder shall not be regarded as a sin whenever a Jew kills a Gentile, but only if a Jew murders a brother in Israel. Neither is it a sin to break an oath sworn to a Gentile. The Jews of our days still keep to these doctrines and follow the example of their fathers, taking every opportunity to practice a deliberately false interpretation of the Lord's word. The avariciousness, their usury, their thefts, their murders, and teaching their children to do likewise. Another, maybe mild-hearted and Gentile Christians will believe I am too rigorous and drastic against the poor, afflicted Jews, believing that I ridicule them and treat them with such sarcasm. By my word, I am far too weak to be able to ridicule such a satanic breed. And another, you should know that the Jews blaspheme and violate the name of our Savior day for day. They are our public enemies and insistently blaspheme our Lord Jesus Christ. They call our Blessed Virgin Mary a harlot and our Holy Son a bastard. And to us they give the epithet of changelings and abortions. If they could kill us all, they would gladly do so. In fact, many murder Christians. And that was from Luther's last sermon a few days before his death in February 1546. There were many tribes, nationalities, and conflicting religious sects that migrated to the great cities of the Roman Empire. Yet of all these groups, only the Jewish tribe has elicited such relentless hostility throughout the centuries. Only the Jewish tribe never assimilated into the Roman population. Could their own Talmudic practices and their disdain for non-Jews have had something to do with the enmity they generated? It seemed logical to me that these things contributed to anti-Jewish sentiments in the West. The contrasting holidays of Christianity and Judaism illustrate the dichotomy between the two religions. Christmas and Easter celebrate universal themes offering hope and salvation for all mankind. Christmas officially commemorates the birth of the Savior and celebrates the desire for peace on earth and goodwill toward men. Easter, a more somber occasion, represents the promise of universal salvation through the resurrection of Christ. While Christians celebrate universal goodwill on their last holy days, Jews celebrate historic military victories against their despised Gentile enemies. Near the time of Christmas, the Jews celebrate Hanukkah, a celebration of their military victory and bloody massacre in 165 BC over their hated enemy, the Greek-descended King Antiochus IV of Syria. The victory finds its remembrance by the miracle of the long-burning oil lamps in their recaptured temple. As Christians enter the Lenten season and prepare for the celebrations of Christ's offer of salvation, Jews celebrate Passover, a holiday that is again based on an ancient conflict between Jew and Gentile. Passover is an unambiguous reference to the night when the spirit of death harmlessly passed over Jewish homes and descended into the homes of their hated Egyptian enemies, killing every firstborn male from newborn to elderly in all of Egypt. It may shock one to realize it, but this is a joyous celebration of mass infanticide and murder among non-Jews. Another important Jewish holiday is the Feast of Lots, called Purim. The Random House Dictionary of the English Language describes it as follows. Purim, a Jewish festival marked chiefly by the reading of the Book of Esther and eating of Hamantaschen, that is celebrated on the 14th day of Adar and the commemoration of the deliverance of Jews in Persia from destruction by Haman. The festival celebrates the Jewish massacre of thousands of Persians along with their prime minister Haman and his 10 sons. It even includes a symbolic eating of the supposed anti-Semites' ears, Haman's ears, Hamantaschen, in the form of three-sided cookies. Another of the favored Purim foods is kreplach, which are dough pockets, again shaped in a triangle to denote Haman's ears, but these snacks are filled with chopped meat, symbolizing the beaten flesh of Haman. Another Purim celebration is Jews beating willow branches in the synagogues as they imagine themselves flogging Haman. The following description of these practices comes from a Jewish culture organization called Jewish Art and Context, but it's found in numerous books about Jewish culture and religious holy days. The second description is from a Jewish cooking guide called Bon Appetit, but these are very common, and you can find many references like this on the internet with a little bit of looking. Under C, special delicacies, 1, Hamantaschen, Osnei Haman, Haman's ears, 2, kreplach, chopped meat covered with dough, also triangular in shape. The name has received a popular etymology. Kreplach are eaten only on days in which there is both hitting and eating. The Yom Kippur Eve, the custom of Kapparot, Hoshanah Rabbah, the beating of the willow branches, Purim, the symbolical beating of Haman. The reason kreplach are eaten on Purim is interesting, if a bit of a stretch. This is from the Jewish source, by the way. Kreplach is also traditional for Yom Kippur and for Hosanna Rabbah, the seventh day of Sukkot. On these days, it was traditional for there to be some sort of beating. On Yom Kippur in ancient times, the men would be flogged before Yom Kippur, and we beat the willow branches on Hosanna Rabbah. On Purim, we beat out the name of Haman, so kreplach became traditional for Purim. Philip Goldwasser, that's from Bon Appetit. Now, upon learning these things, I realized that if any group other than Jews had similar ceremonies, Jews would label them hateful and barbaric. Imagine, for instance, if white Christians were to yearly observe a ritual in which they made and ate cookies shaped to represent the ears of Martin Luther King and held a holy ceremony in which they symbolically whipped him. Purim has been celebrated annually since long before the time of Christ, and certainly has been important in fomenting hatred and suspicion of Gentiles in the hearts and minds of Jewish children. The repulsive ceremony is analogous to Christian churches teaching our children to symbolically beat the Jewish Pharisees who condemned Jesus, and then eating foods symbolizing the pulverized body parts of the Jewish priests. Of course, such activities would be completely antithetical to the spirit of Christianity, yet such revengeful attitudes form the very core of Jewish tradition. The next section is Zionism as racism. After 2,000 years of conflict, the Jewish prayer next year in Jerusalem has finally become expressed in an open political movement called Zionism. In 1862, Moses Hess, the teacher of Karl Marx and the spiritual father of both Zionism and communism, wrote Rome and Jerusalem. In it, he expressed the familiar Talmudic values. We Jews shall always remain strangers among the Goyim, Gentiles. It is a fact. The Jewish religion is above all Jewish nationalism. Each and every Jew, whether or not he wishes it, is automatically, by virtue of his birth, bound in solidarity with his entire nation. One must be a Jew first and a human being second. If Adolf Hitler had ever said the words, one must be a German first and human being second, would not those words be repeated often as proof of his depravity? For some compelling reason, no one dares to condemn such words when they come from the important Jewish leader who laid the foundations of both Zionism and communism. I began to survey Zionist literature from the writings of Moses Hess to the present day, and repeatedly I encountered the same supremacism expressed in the Talmud. A prominent Zionist historian, Simon Dubnow, wrote The Foundation of National Judaism in 1906. In it, he expressed sentiments that would certainly be described as anti-Semitic had they come from a Gentile. Quote, assimilation is common treason against the banner and ideals of the Jewish people, but one can never become a member of a national group, such as a family, a tribe, a nation. A Jew, on the other hand, even if he happened to be born in France and still lives there, in spite of all this, he remains a member of the Jewish nation. And whether he likes it or not, whether he's aware of it or unaware of it, he bears the seal of the historic evolution of the Jewish nation. In 1965, Moshe Menuhin, an Israeli who was born into an extremely prominent Hasidic family, dared to write an expose of Jewish hypocrisy. He wrote a fascinating book called The Decadence of Judaism. He was a graduate of the yeshiva in Jerusalem and was the father of the prominent Israeli musical performer Yehudi Menuhin. Menuhin documents the influential modern Zionist writer Jacob Klatskin addressing the world at large in his 1921 German language book Crisis and Entscheidung, Crisis and Decision. Klatskin writes, "We are not hyphenated Jews. We are Jews with no qualifications or reservations. We are simply aliens. We are a foreign people in your midst, and we emphasize we wish to stay that way. There is a wide gap between you and us, so wide that no bridge can be laid across. Your spirit is alien to us. Your myths, legends, habits, customs, traditions, and national heritage, your religious and national shrines, your Sundays and holidays, they are all alien to us. The history of your triumphs and defeats, your war songs and battle hymns, your heroes and their mighty deeds, your national ambitions and aspirations, they're all alien to us. The boundaries of your lands cannot restrict our movements, and your border clashes are not of our concern. Far over and above the frontiers and boundaries of your land stand our Jewish unity. Whosoever calls the foreign Gentile land a fatherland is a traitor to the Jewish people. A loyal Jew can never be other than a Jewish patriot. We recognize a national unity of the diaspora Jews, no matter in which country they may reside. Therefore, no boundaries can restrain us in pursuing our own Jewish policy." And ladies and gentlemen, as a side note, they're doing that, of course, today. They pursue that policy in the Iraq War, in the Middle East, and they're controlling our country in so many ways. Before the Second World War, Noam Goldman, president of the World Zionist Organization, urged German Jews to immigrate to Palestine using the following blunt words. Judaism can have nothing in common with Germanism. If we go by the standards of race, history, and culture, and the Germans do have the right to prevent Jews from intruding on the affairs of their folk, the same demand I raise for the Jewish folk as against the German. The Jews are divided into two categories, those who admit they belong to a race distinguished by a history thousands of years old, and those who don't. The latter are open to the charge of dishonesty. Even Judge Louis Brandeis, the Zionist who sat on the American Supreme Court, said it succinctly, Jews are a distinct nationality. Whatever his country, his station, or his shade of belief, he is necessarily a member. Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, expresses the true causes of what he calls the Jewish question. This is Theodor Herzl. Again, this is the father of Zionism. The Jewish question exists whenever Jews are to be found in large numbers. Every nation in whose midst Jews live is either covertly or openly anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism increases day by day and hour by hour among the nations. Indeed, it is bound to increase because the causes of its growth continue to exist and cannot be removed. Its immediate causes are excessive production of mediocre intellects who cannot find an outlet downwards or upwards. That is to say, no wholesome outlet in either direction. When we sink, we become a revolutionary proletariat. The subordinate officers of all revolutionary parties at the same time when we rise, there rises also our terrible power of the purse. Unquote. The Jews' exclusivity, their resistance to assimilation, their alien traditions and customs, their often questionable economic practices, and their carefully nurtured hateful attitude toward other peoples and religions, all these factors have contributed to a reaction from the Christian world that at times became extreme. With each persecution the Jews suffered, their own distrust and antipathy toward Gentiles became intensified in their own writings and in patterns of behavior that engendered still more persecution. A cycle of recrimination began that still continues as we embark on the early years of the 21st century. A whole generation of Jews is now growing up inundated with stories of Gentile perfidy. Not only are the Germans and the Eastern Europeans blamed for the Holocaust, but now there are many Jewish-authored books arguing that all the Western nations share in the guilt, as well as President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Catholic Church, and indeed the entire Christian world. I discovered that to draw attention to the writings of the Talmud and to quote the very words used by modern Jewish leaders and writers invites the charge of anti-Semitism. It seemed to me that if repeating the words of Jewish leaders is anti-Semitism, then there must be distasteful elements in the words themselves. Maybe one should consider the historical Jewish attitude toward Gentiles pertinent to assessing the causes of anti-Semitism. Bernard, a popular Jewish intellectual in France in the 19th century, investigated his people's role in the age-old conflict with other peoples. In the widely circulated book, L'Antisemitisme, he wrote, if this hostility, this repugnance, had been shown toward the Jews at one time or in one country only, it would be easy to account for the local causes of this sentiment. But this race has been the object of hatred with all the nations amidst whom it's ever settled. Inasmuch as the enemies of the Jews belong to diverse races, it must be that the general causes of anti-Semitism have always resided in Israel itself and not in those who antagonized it. Unquote. Some might argue that the anti-Gentile tone of the Talmud and the founding Zionists has little relevance to the Jews of today. The evidence, however, is that the core of Judaism, Orthodoxy, is steadily becoming more, rather than less, more extreme against Gentiles than in previous generations. The Encyclopedia Judaica says as much in its article on the subject. Perhaps this development could have been predicted with the advent of modern film. Cinema and television wield an enormous influence on human emotions. Jewish producers create endless accounts of the persecutions of Jews, all the way from the Torah to the Holocaust. Thousands of well-crafted films, from the Ten Commandments to Schindler's List, graphically remind Jews of Gentile perfidy while softening Gentiles to Jewish causes. The incessantly repeated horrific stories of the Holocaust can only serve to heighten the suspicions of the average Jew toward Gentiles while underscoring the need for Jewish solidarity among Jews. Modern Jewish supremacism. As I read more and more of the historical accounts of Jewish ethnocentrism, I wondered how much of this applied to the modern-day Jews. I began to devour modern Jewish books and publications. I chose their most popular and respected newspapers, books, and magazines. Because I was now beginning to see a double standard, I began to look for corroborating evidence, and what I found fascinated me. In fact, finding it was easy, and it still is. Prominent Jews still proudly write and publish articles about their suspicion and condemnation of Gentiles. They boast of Jewish moral, spiritual, and genetic superiority. Even admissions of control over key positions in media and government in Gentile nations are in their contemporary literature. Any reader of publications meant for Jewish consumption will find material no less anti-Gentile than the 1,500-year-old Talmudic writ I quoted. It is seldom as brazen as the old material, but the underlying themes are inevitably present, and sometimes even unvarnished hatred just spills out. Many examples of what I'm talking about can be found in the largest Jewish newspaper outside of Israel, the Jewish Press, which sets the tone of Jewish religious and cultural attitudes more than any other newspaper. One of its primary religious authorities is Rabbi Simcha Cohen, who has an instructional Dear Abby type of column called Halakhic Questions. Not long ago, Rabbi Cohen instructed his readers that the Talmud denotes Gentiles as, quote, animals, as outlined by Talmudic writings from Gemara, Kedushin 68a, and Metziah 114b. In another section, he discusses how a Jewish woman is not designated as a prostitute if she has premarital sex with a Jew, but she is a whore if she has any sexual relations with a Gentile, even if she's married to him. Marriage to a Gentile can never be sanctified or condoned. This is a quote from his article. Such a liaison classifies the woman as a zona. Common parlance interprets the term zona to refer to prostitute. Indeed, premarital sex of a Jewish woman to a Jewish man does not automatically brand the woman as a zona. A Jewish woman becomes a prostitute or a zona in the eyes of the Talmud only when she marries or otherwise has sexual relations with a non-Jew. Another major Jewish publication, the Jewish Chronicle, in an article called Some Carefully and Carelessly Chosen Words, revealed that the Jewish term for Gentile woman is the offensive Yiddish word shiksa, meaning whore, from the Hebrew root shigetz, abomination. It also pointed out that a little Jewish girl is called shikselba, meaning little female abomination. Now, how would Jews react if Gentiles casually referred to Jewish women and Jewish little girls as whores and little whores? Moreover, not only Christians, but also non-Christians of all races are regarded as supernal refuse by Talmud teachers, such as the founder of Chabad Lubavitch, Rabbi Schneer Zalman. The Chabad is a powerful movement within Hasidim. The New Republic magazine, which has a mostly Jewish staff, had some revealing admissions in a May 1992 edition. There are some powerful ironies in Chabad's new messianic universalism in its mission to the Gentiles, and certainly the most unpleasant of them concerns Chabad's otherwise undisguised and even racial contempt for the Goyim. As for the Goyim, Zalman's attitude was Gentile souls are of a completely different and inferior order. They are totally evil, with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Consequently, references to Gentiles in Rabbi Schneer Zalman's teachings are invariably invidious. Their non-Jews' material abundance derives from supernal refuse. Indeed, they themselves derive from refuse, which is why there are more numerous Gentiles than Jews. As the pieces of chaff outnumber the kernels, all Jews were innately good, all Gentiles innately evil. Moreover, this characterization of Gentiles as being inherently evil, as being spiritually as well as biologically inferior to Jews, has not in any way been revised in later Chabad writing. That's directly from the New Republic. And recently, the Chabad has been doing teachings, and there's been ceremonies of the Chabad, including the most recent Chabad Rebbe, the Great Rebbe, in the White House itself, the White House of the United States. Now, it's true that all Jews do not have the extreme views of the Chabad, who are an integral part of the Jewish Orthodox religion. However, imagine if a movement existed within the Catholic or Methodist Church claiming that Jews or blacks are pieces of garbage and totally evil and have no redeeming qualities, that they're not even human beings. Would there not be a great outcry? The Jews have demanded that the Catholic Church take out of their liturgy anything that Jews deem as offensive, and the Catholics, as well as other Christian denominations, have done so. Yet, no one dares to insist that the Jewish faith should expunge references to Gentiles as, quote, innately evil with inferior souls, unquote. As I began to look at these issues from a new perspective, I saw that Judaism is centered in the preservation of Jewish heritage and the advancement of Jewish interests. In examining some of the encyclopedias and biographical reference works compiled by rabbinical authorities, I found prominent Jews listed who were self-proclaimed atheists and communists, as mentioned in the last chapter. Leon Trotsky, one of the main atheist perpetrators of the Russian Revolution, and Herbert Aptheker, the atheist chief theoretician of the Communist Party USA, are proudly listed in Jewish directories such as Who's Who in World Jewry and Who's Who in American Jewry. These books are compiled by the leading rabbinical organizations of America. The Jewish religion, as codified by the Talmud, is less concerned with an afterlife than with the survival and power of the Jewish people. Driven by the belief that Jews are the chosen people, Judaism is held together by chronic recitals of past persecutions. In a world that renounces racism, Judaism is the only creed on earth being praised for fostering genetic exclusion, elitism, ethnocentrism, and supremacism. Modern Israel is the only Western state that's openly theocratic, unashamedly proclaiming itself to be a nation whose purpose is to advance one religion and one unique people. Israel defines Judaism as the state religion with little separation of church and state in its civil and religious laws. In spite of their religious state, most Jews in Israel identify themselves as secular. But even the non-religious Jews of Israel and America support the Orthodox-run state of Israel, and they support numerous organizations run by Orthodox Jews around the world. They support it as a mechanism for preserving their cultural and racial heritage. Most of us never see the reality of Jewish chauvinism and power, because we have not organized the scattered facts into a coherent whole. Like a child's connect-the-dot puzzle, most of us have not yet connected the dots and completed the picture. The media erase as many dots as they can from our awareness, and anyone who succeeds in connecting all the dots is bludgeoned back with the ultimate moral weapon, accusations of anti-Semitism. Given the Jewish influences that have so much power in this nation's media and finance, it is amazing that any Gentiles would dare oppose them. Once accused of being an anti-Semite, one faces an intractable enemy organized around the world, one that will do whatever it takes to discredit, intimidate, jail, and destroy him. After I completed a survey of readings in the Talmud and of the modern Zionist writers, I realized that the Europeans were not the only historical practitioners of racial and religious intolerance. Actually, the Jews have been quite proficient at it themselves. Once I accepted that Jewish ethnocentrism existed, again, I asked the question. The question that had arose after my enlightenment on the, quote, Russian Revolution. Why were we forbidden to know this? A Jew can rightly object to slanderous criticism from Christians. Why should I, as a Christian, not be upset by slanderous criticism of my heritage by Jews? If Christians are wrong to voice hateful sentiments against Jews, why are not Jews just as reprehensible for voicing hateful sentiments against Christians? Are the media right in suggesting that Christians have a monopoly on hate, while Jews have a monopoly on charity? Which religion, as judged by the evidence of its own writings, is more motivated by hatred? Even as I write these provocative words, I harbor no hatred toward the Jewish people. There are intolerant Jews just as there are intolerant Gentiles. It's also true that there are many Jews who respect our Christian heritage. But unless the non-chauvinist Jews are willing to work hard to bring to their own faith and community the same kind of love and reconciliation that Christ taught, the cycle of hatred between Jew and Gentile could fester. Unless they temper their supremacism with acceptance and love, they could suffer a replay of the terrible excesses of the past. The government, church, and media establishment work zealously to diminish Gentile intolerance of Jews. That objective can be realized only through an equal effort to lessen Jewish chauvinism, suspicion, and anger against Gentiles. As Israeli human rights activist Israel Shahak wrote, anti-Semitism and Jewish chauvinism can only be fought simultaneously. After reading the words of Zionism's modern founder, Theodor Herzl, I fully realize that there are, as he expressed it, alien power brokers in our civilization. These are people who do not share our culture, our traditions, our faith, our interests, or our values. I realize that if I desire to preserve the heritage and values of my people, I would have to defend my people from the intolerant sector within the Jewish community that seeks domination rather than reconciliation. When I was 16, I never suspected that just by pointing out the powerful Jewish elements of anti-Gentilism, I would be labeled anti-Semitic. I do not accept that label today. And I still believe that it is no more anti-Semitic to oppose Jewish supremacism than it is anti-Italian to oppose the Mafia.
The next chapter is chapter 16, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.